This episode of Hacks and Flacks was recorded in early December 2022, when the hype continued to grow around Prince Harry's upcoming autobiography, Spare. The world only had 1 week to wait until the much-anticipated series Harry and Meghan dropped onto Netflix, and Buckingham Palace was left reeling after a charity worker accused a senior royal aide of racism at an event hosted by the Queen Consort.
Hello and welcome to Hacks and Flacks with me, Petri Hoskin. Hacks and Flacks is the only series where you'll get the inside scoop on how journalist hacks and the flacks of government and business work behind the scenes to decide which stories you'll be reading with your morning coffee, and perhaps more importantly, how they keep certain headlines off the front pages. What happens if a public figure is a subject of a salacious story? When does a scandal make or break a career? And how do you really know what is or isn't fake news? All these subjects and a whole lot more will be explored by me and a regular panel of hacks and flacks, ready to spill the beans and tell us how the sausages get made. Flacks like former government advisers Giles Kenningham.
Hello.
And Andrew McDougall.
Hello.
Plus hacks like Mick Booker.
Hello.
So now all the gang's here, let's delve into the world of hacks and flacks. Hello, I'm Petri Hoskin and this is Hacks and Flacks. In this episode, we're rolling out the red carpet and practising our curtsies as we doff our caps to talk scandals of the royal kind. Now, what sets a salacious story from the House of Windsor apart from one involving politicians or celebrities? How does a story involving the monarchy get leaked in the first place? And why might the press decide not to put something about the royals in the public domain? Well, as always, I'm joined by a regular panel of experts, and this week's jewels in the crown are princes of the press and politics. I couldn't keep a straight face there. Mick Booker and Andrew McDougall. Hello.
Hello.
Oh, nice royal wave.
I'm just practicing.
Like
I'm getting into the spirit of things.
And also we have a new member of the team who happens to be a right royal knockout in the world of journalism and broadcasting, Joe Elvin, who also hosts the Daily Mail's weekly royal talk show, Palace Confidential. Welcome, Joe.
It's my favourite introduction ever.
Yeah.
Thank you.
You are so
thanks for
welcome.
Having me.
I didn't write it. But I meant
she meant every word.
I mean, you delivered it with word. Such sincerity that's going on all of my LinkedIns, my business card, everything. Right royal knockout.
Yeah, I meant yeah. every word. So let's start. How does a royal scandal differ from just a normal celebrity scandal? Come to you first.
I think because the royal family are the most rarefied breed of famous people on the planet. They're there for no other reason than birth. They're funded by the British taxpayer, in which, you know, obviously a lot of people have very strong feelings about. They've always lived in this very protected bubble. So it's very, very difficult to get any real insight and any real facts about what they're all really talking about and what they're all really doing behind those palace walls. So any sliver is just absolute catnip to everybody.
And are they literally, Mick, the king and queen of celebrity?
Well, what I used to like in my newspaper days, and you know, when I first came down in the early noughties, there was this idea that, oh, you got the impression that you could say what you liked about the royal family because they never complain, never explain, that sort of thing. So it did, it was like, hold on, you can say what you like and they don't sue you. This sounds great. And I think there was that feeling that, you know, and obviously...
Well, I wish I'd had those days. That sounds so fun. Yeah.
But, you know, so it was just an impression I got from all the older reporters and the older people in the newspaper. It was like, well, if these royal scandals, it was just open season. Whenever one blew up, like late 90s, early noughties, and it was Diana and Charles and things like that, it just seemed as though people would say whatever they liked, make huge allegations, and it ended up in newspapers on the front. But at the end of the day, I mean, looking back and looking at, say, like the News of the World and stories like that they had in the 90s, a lot of it did come from very, very good sources, close to very people like Princess Diana anyway. So it may have appeared as though it was open season and it was easy to say these things, but they were very well sourced, and a lot of them, there was infighting between themselves.
On the top of that, a lot of reporters ended up having very, very close relationships with people like Diana.
Yeah, and I think this is, for me, it's kind of the intersection of ultra-celebrity,
ultra cluelessness about how to deal with anything in the real world, to your point, Joe. Like, these people just don't know what real is. Mm-hmm. And so you get this complete car crash, you know, every time they seem to get into something, covered with this kind of faux, what Mick was describing a bit, this politeness or politesse that we're supposed to have between what is, in fact, you know, the top of the constitutional order in the country, right? Like, this is not an insignificant institution, even if it's staffed by insignificant and really quite ridiculous people. So, like, what wouldn't you like about that cocktail of scandal and cluelessness?
It's not just the royals that are quite secretive. It's, for me, it's also the people who advise them. I mean, we're given names, we know roughly, but we don't know really much about them, or is that changing?
I think that they sometimes become the story, and that becomes a problem for them. Obviously, they're very well known to the Royal Rota of reporters, but it's absolutely part of the whole mystique and the whole never complain, never explain, that those people are not the story. And when they become the story, that's a huge problem, and they usually have to resign.
And Mick, when you were in papers, what kind of steps would you take to get close to these advisors, or get your team to get close to them, so that you would get these little nuggets?
When I was on the Daily Star, it's not as easy as all that. On the Express, when you're in the royal pool and you join the club effectively, don't you? You're in the pool, you get what you're given, you get you know, the royal reporter who is part of that. They go on these trips, they get certain access, and there was that trade-off. That seems to be fracturing a little bit more. And just going back to your point about the PRs, in the old days, I'd only ever heard of Dickie Arbiter, and that was the only one you'd ever heard of. Now there's, because that we see stories in the Times about all these various Jasons and Annabelles and what's
yes.
it.
And there's always an Annabelle. Yeah, yeah. Always.
And particularly with Meghan and Harry and with the Prince and Princess of Wales now, they seem to be changing them every 5 minutes, and we hear these stories about alleged bullying and things like that. And as you said, they become the story. Now, in the olden days, it didn't seem to be. It just seemed to be about, well, my favourite phrase in the papers was a senior courtier.
Yeah.
And these courtiers seem to be everywhere, just briefing people, and they're just darkly in corridors in the palace.
That's the thing. It's very Game of Thrones, isn't yeah. it? Sort of like yeah. whispering something, and then with the cloaked figure goes back into the shadows. Like,
where's that courtier gone?
but you can't change the people in the palace, right? So there's the permanence there. So if something has to change, it is the people around them. And to your point now, I think everybody's competing for that oxygen of celebrity and clicks and stuff like that. So the royal, you know, royal stuff sold papers, I'm sure, in the days before the internet. But royal scandal probably gets more clicks than just about anything. So there is. And now you have the factionalism between the brothers, allegedly. Come on, we all know.
I don't think it's that alleged.
Well, no, it's quite. But you get this. You get this incentive then, especially with Harry and Meghan being chucked out. Negotiating their exit from the royal family.
They left for a life of privacy.
Oh yes, coming to Netflix tomorrow, apparently. So you get this environment where there is the incentive to kind of rat fuck each other and like be the political spin side of it, going, look, she's a real, see you next Tuesday. You know, she's a bit crazy.
But you mean see you next Friday?
Well, yes, that's the new word we're trying to.
New word.
Oh, really?
We're trying to get it trending. Comf.
Well, I should choose to get all the credit,
Jill. Right, let's go to Harry and Meghan. You brought them into the conversation.
Yes.
They are never off the front pages. But, I mean, I must admit, when I see TV networks continually talk about them, I'm like, oh, bore off. You know, are people really that interested?
Yes. I mean, I think that all you have to see is the amount of coverage space they get and interest in this, you know, and that my partner is a television journalist for Canada based here. And anything royal happens, it is automatically a contender for the lineup in Canada, because people in Canada care about this institution and they care about the drama behind it. So, yeah, I mean, if they weren't box office, they would shut up because nobody would be paying attention to them.
It's definitely the drama that surrounds the rift between Harry and the rest of the family. And all the, you know, back to your point about never complain, never explain. Well, there's been a lot of complaining and explaining in the last couple of years. And so that is absolutely fascinating for people to have that narrative and to then add their own narrative and their own speculation to it. And so it sort of feeds itself. I know that Harry and Meghan are very fond of complaining about the press intrusion, but I just keep thinking about this woman who's always telling us that she has no voice and had no voice. I don't think I've ever heard anyone's voice more than I have Meghan's in the last 2 years. Mm. They could go and have this authentic life with their chickens in their million-dollar mansion without any of this drama, but they choose to keep putting themselves in the
public
eye.
But isn't it about money? Don't they need the money?
Well, this is the other thing. It's extraordinary. I mean, my personal view is, why do they need the money? It's when I heard Harry on that Oprah interview saying, but I've only got my mother's inheritance left. That's when I parted company. I was all there for respect for, you know, yeah, go and live your private life. That must be awful living like that. I completely get it. But I haven't seen more of a couple than I have those two. How much money do you need? They could go and live in a nice $1 million bungalow in, you know, probably can't get one for $1 million in Beverly Hills, can you? But, you know,
Crenshaw.
I've seen some nice
Someone selling Sunset. Yeah.
Why do they need multi-millions? Why?
It's also an interesting clash of tactics now, because you have the new world of celebrity kind of feel your pain-ism, which they're the first royals to really, well, Diana was kind of the start of that.
Yeah.
And now it's kind of its next iteration being countered by the never complain, never explain. And you do see these little shivs that come from William and Kate, you presume, that kind of deflate those balloons, particularly around when the Queen passed away. You saw some very artful spin to lower the tension so it wasn't about anything other than Her Majesty's passing and paying the proper respect. But it was the classic old school courtier, I imagine, sneaking out of those shadows, going with the kill shot and then receding, and then watching the new world feel your pain.
I do
Sussexes
think, though, where we are
through.
Now, where their story started together, and I was deputy editor on the Daily Express when the Sunday Express broke the world exclusive that Harry was with Meghan. And obviously, we weren't jealous at all of our sister paper doing that.
No, that just never happens. No. Having worked on the Sunday Mail, I know.
No, all we simply did was applaud, you know, the garlands around all the staff's neck. No, anyway, so there we were, jealous as hell. But that first splash, Harry and Meghan, I don't think it mentioned anywhere in there that it didn't make a point of it being mixed race or anything. All the things that are now chucked back about racism, things like that, I just remember it being a really happy story. No one mentioned there was no controversy
either.
Over it. It was just simply the fact, holy hell, he's with this corking looking woman.
Yeah,
it was the opposite from what I remember. Yeah, it was isn't it great that the family's getting more diverse?
I worked at the Mail, and that was the narrative. It was like, how fabulous and modern for this royal family that this
century.
Is happening. This is amazing. That was the narrative.
Yeah.
And so this is why people get frustrated.
Yeah, until she turned up on Oprah and started lying her face off. Quite demonstrably,
but that's the thing, isn't it? I mean, why lie? Even a judge has said that happened. So we know that there was lying. Why say that? Why keep going on about press intrusion? Why mention the fact that, you know, she couldn't walk her children to school without a paparazzi pack there, which we know is palpably untrue? Because
the Americans believe it.
Yeah, is that all she needs? Just somebody to believe it?
I honestly,
or does she believe it?
Because obviously with the show I do, I have to talk about this stuff all the time. In my real life, I don't think about the royals very much at all, honestly. You'd have to ask Meghan, what do you guys think? I don't get it.
Attention.
Of course.
She just has to keep the Meghan machine rolling, doesn't she?
When it's provably untrue, there was even a comment, wasn't there, that she was married before the wedding. Even the Archbishop said, no, that wouldn't happen. Mm. I mean, if you're going to lie, be good at it.
But this is the post-truth world, right? Remember when we talked about
it's
true in
truth.
Politics as it is in royals. It is exactly that. And as long as enough people believe your version, your lived experience, your truth, then you can have a fight. Then it becomes my camp against your camp.
Yeah.
So it's like, it's everywhere. It's not just politics. It's not just business. It is royals.
I'm also fascinated with how much the family do clearly genuinely care about this stuff, like when you were saying about the little sort of like shivs that were brought out during the funeral for the Queen. I seem to remember, was it one of Diana's anniversaries, her birthday, I think, what would have been her birthday, William putting a note out that one of his children had written to Granny, sort of like reclaiming ownership over, she was my mother as well.
Yeah.
Rather, you know, because Harry seems to have sort of like stolen that narrative as well.
What interesting as well, one of our colleagues who's not on this podcast, Giles Kenningham, said that this is diminishing returns on these stories and this,
rare,
you know,
interventions.
Where's it going to go?
I don't know.
We've got the Netflix and then the book. After that, what can they do to keep...
Sex tape.
Oh, no,
I'll go full Kardashian.
How much can we pay for that never, never to see the light of day?
Yeah.
I think that there's going to be so much more shit to put back in the horse when that comes out.
I just think it's going to be a lovey-dovey fest.
I think it's going to be another trip to victim town.
I see the thing that's upset a lot of people who don't like them is there's that shot in the Abbey of Kate looking stern to attack Kate in that way, or the Princess of Wales.
Yeah, that's not an accident.
No.
Yeah.
And she seems to be there.
But yeah, I mean, it is a diminishing return because I think maybe this is something that's now been pressed home because we've just had the change in the sovereign and how important the institution is, despite all this kind of laughter that we're having here about these silly people. The institution itself matters. And in the political chaos that we've had here, to watch that transition happen seamlessly with King Charles III's now authority stamped on everything much more smoothly than we thought probably it would ever happen, it just shows you how trivial and petty this is. And people will get upset if they drag the institution into the muck anymore, because we've just seen that it matters.
I think you're absolutely right. And I think that something I probably didn't really appreciate or think about or respect as much until I started doing this Palace Confidential is the power that they bring to soft diplomacy. Mm-hmm. And I think that has been... The Queen has shown that historically for decades, but, you know, recently the state dinner for South Africa, I think that is so much more powerful in a lot of ways for government relations than so many other things that other countries can do.
Yeah, and I would just say, when I worked for the Prime Minister of Canada, he would always appreciate his time with Queen Elizabeth II. And his point was always, how many times in your working life are you going to meet someone who has met so many people over the years, leaders, statesmen, from the private sector, and she was an excellent judge of character. And he said he could get a readout from Her Majesty on if she had met the new Italian prime minister when they were going through one every 4 months, and would really value that. And that kind of insight into kind of power and global power.
I always thought this country would actually have a proper meltdown when the Queen died. It was obviously a huge occasion. There was a lot on. And obviously she was at a very, very old age. And I did think there was going to be some, you know, existential problem that this country had without her, and that doesn't seem to have happened. But when you do appear now to have this open season fighting between William, well, it's all one-sided fighting at the moment, isn't it, between the brothers.
Well, it always will William, be, won't it? Because William won't fight back.
But I don't know. He does seem to be a guy with a bit of steel in him.
And a temper.
And a temper that we hear. So, I don't know. I wouldn't want to make an enemy of him, particularly, but Harry's got him now as an enemy for life.
Andrew, if I can come to you in PR terms, if you were advising King Charles at the moment, he's got a very tricky path to tread right now, because what's he going to do? Is he going to cut Andrew off? We haven't even got to Andrew yet, Prince Andrew, and Harry off. He's already lowered them down the ranking and all of those things. But if you were advising him, would you say, no, keep your enemies close? Because that's what he appears to be doing at the moment.
Yeah, I would. You know, some people wear these bracelets. What would Jesus do? The WWJD. I'd have WWED. What would Elizabeth do? And try to keep that in mind, because I think she struck that balance quite well of putting her arms around her children when she had to, but being firm with them when she had to. And I think that looks to be his approach. But yeah, he cannot become a participant in this cheap and tawdry drama. He is the sovereign. He is the institution.
But what about the book? What if the book comes out and we've told that it's got a whole thing about him and Camilla in it?
You know, when you say it's something out of sorrow, not anger, I think whatever they do would have to keep that tone. It's unfortunate that some people are choosing to do this. And you can't get into it any more than that. You just can't make it a bigger thing than it is. And if they punch themselves out on the other side trying to make this a thing, they'll look like the assholes. And I think everybody will get that.
Yeah.
And will treat it that way.
And I think that what's important for the institution is to carry that dignity and to keep that high road. And I think
it seems so unfair, doesn't it, when you're being attacked?
Well, maybe it does, but even you saying that, I think, shows that ultimately, history will be kinder to the institution that took the high road.
Mick, though, I know that certainly on one of the book things that I use, Harry's book is selling for a penny, advanced sales, and some of them are just for one credit.
But try to get it to the top of the ranking.
That's the thing. But every newsroom, royal editor, is buying that book, right?
Well, of course.
And going through it. How many front page, I mean, how many newspapers are they going to get?
So, for instance, at GB News, you know, our head of digital, the one thing he says, what's flying every day? Royals. What's flying every day? Royals.
Really?
What's flying every day? Royals. And it always has been the case. When we're on the Express, royal stories. just flying, because it's, again, it's around the world from the point we first met. They're, everyone knows who they are all across the world. You know?
Yeah.
So, yeah, everyone wants that. And it's dead easy as well in terms of news.
You know, yeah, you just take a paragraph, blow it up well, into no, a double page spread,
it's,
and
it's there. It's you, it's you know, you've got it's a soap opera just playing out free. There you go. There's your story. Brilliant. And it just it's going to keep going and keep going. And that book is going to be mined and mined and mined and mined and mined. And it's going to be brilliant for the media, but for the country and for the institution, it's going to be, you know, a huge problem for them.
How do you mind something that's written in crayon?
But the problem is, again, just going back to the point about Meghan and why she keeps doing this stuff, is because a lot of people don't believe the royal family because they've never covered themselves massively in glory in the first place. True. Over the years, they've ditched people very quickly. They've treated people terribly, you know, going back hundreds of years. And so there isn't this reputation that they look after people particularly. And at some point, Meghan might have got completely burned by them anyway. So she thinks, well, I may as well get in first and keep doing it and keep doing it. And you know, she's doing very well out of it.
And this is where being a North American probably helps, because you don't have that any sort of inbuilt respect for the institution either. It's about celebrity.
And they loved Canada when they lived there for 20 minutes.
I just think that she never understood what it was that the institution was. I don't think she understood. I think she thought it was, wow, I thought I wanted to be a Hollywood star, but this is like fame on a whole other stratosphere, when actually it's a lot of warm sandwiches in church halls, which is not really her style.
Was that
at all
line about, shouldn't I get paid for it, when she was doing the walkabout? That was my favourite.
Amazing. Absolutely. Australia.
Australia.
Amazing. It's like, you are getting paid for it, love. I'm paying for it.
Yeah.
But it's interesting now that you have Harry and Meghan kind of in the Diana position, and you have William in the Charles position, and another generation. But it's interesting, like you become your parents and whatever, but it is that, you know, and whether who got whose brains and whatever, that's a separate question, but but it is interesting, and the kind of psychology and behind it all is I have no doubt that it's a painful life to be famous for no reason other than your birth, and to know that you have no purpose,
and quite really boring,
because you're quite literally spare. At least William has the role that Charles had for so many years that was frustrating. But you know you're going to get to the top at some point, so there's a reason to kind of stick with it. But if you're not, you're just, you know, you're kind of like an appendix.
But Harry has done a lot. He's done a lot.
And he
could have continued to do that. Using that word spare, Harry, I think, is the first person who's ever framed that word in a derogatory sense. Yeah. It was always just a bit of a joke. You've got to have the air and the spare. It was never a you mean nothing connotation from anybody I've ever heard it from.
But it's quite extraordinary, isn't it, that Harry has done something that is extraordinary, in that he was the most loved royal. Everybody cheeky chat. I mean, even when he dressed as a Nazi, he was forgiven for it.
Well, he was
a young lad.
He came back from it. He went to Vegas, got naked.
I respected that.
Everybody loved him. And he's turned it around.
Well, I was on the Star at that time. I think the News of the World and the Sun had all those pictures, but it wasn't done in any malice about him. It was like,
he's being a lad.
That's what lads do.
And he was a soldier.
Yeah.
We loved him for that.
He was a hero.
We loved him. Yeah. But he's literally managed to take all that goodwill, it seems, and flush it down the loo.
Because he's not the boss in the relationship.
Well, no, right? And it does seem to me that, I mean, from the outside looking in, it's like she has advised him that he's not happy. Mm. And here are the reasons why.
No,
because he used to be happy.
Yeah. You're a new age psychologist now, you know, spouting this absolute bullshit all the time.
You know? And do you blame Meghan for this relationship and the way it's playing
out? I think he was lost and very, very damaged and pained after his mother died. I don't think any of us will ever forget watching that tiny boy walk in that procession. It was hideous. Mm-hmm. And I really understand that must have been something that defines your life. And I think that from then on, he's been very, very angry with the media, which I also understand. And I think that he's been slightly lost in himself and came across this very strong, very gorgeous, very dynamic woman. And I think he's clung onto her like an anchor. So I think she is in control of that relationship, but I don't really see it as I'm wearing the pants thing. He wants her to wear the pants.
Yeah.
I know we normalise it, but it is the weirdest situation and the weirdest family situation possible to be in part of a royal family in any country. To be that rarefied from the moment you're born can't be good for anyone. You know,
no, but
everyone,
that
of us, think as though we'd like to have a go at it, palaces, you know, whatever you want.
It appears that that's what she wanted. though.
Yeah, but she saw it from the outside. It was almost like she dipped in, got in, got the good stuff, and then gone again.
This sucks. Yeah.
Yeah, no, and I think makes a very serious point, though, that it is a horribly damaging environment to try to be in, and especially the family doesn't take any particular steps to assuage any of those concerns, whether for Diana or for any new entrant into the family. You should have a full-on onboarding, and I'm sure they do in some sense, but like on the psychology and the counseling of it, you need to be a stoic to kind of get in there and learn to appreciate that your past no longer matters. You can't get back to it.
And I think
you have to appreciate what you do have in the present, whether that's the local town hall, the sandwiches, meeting interesting people and trying to brighten their day, because they know when they meet you, that means something to them, and take that as something that is worth doing.
Yeah.
Because we've seen the value of the institution again. And the value of the institution is built not through grand gestures like coronations, but it is in that I met the Queen.
Yeah.
You know, my dad was on city council in Ottawa in the early 80s, and Charles and Diana came to open the new police station in Ottawa. And my dad and my mom, who's a Brit, got to meet them. And my mom will still talk about that day, has the picture up in the house as a very important moment for them. And that's the value of it, is making the commoner feel special.
Well, I remember our primary school up in Durham when I was a kid. We never got any royal visits, but apparently we were told that the Queen was on a train coming across some. It was like this big patch of wasteland over about 2 miles of it. So we half the school went there just to watch a train. Wow. Could have been anything. I don't know if she was on it, but we all went there, and that
the
was
8:16 to Doncaster
on a wet Wednesday afternoon or something like that. But that's what it means to the country, isn't it?
Now, as observers of the Queen's funeral, did you think, Joe, that Meghan and Harry were surprised at the level and the numbers of people that turned out? That didn't write into their narrative?
That's a really good question. I can't imagine that Harry would have been surprised by that. He knows the meaning of his grandmother, the Queen. I think I was surprised at the influx of people from other countries who I saw openly sobbing in the streets. And I think I was a bit taken aback by that, but I think I didn't really understand it. But then sort of people said to me, but the thing is, it just brings up so many other things, like something like the Queen dying. It's just something that you just didn't even really think would ever really happen. And so if the Queen can die, then my parents can die. You know, it's little, it just brings up all of those other sort of like related griefs for people, I think.
Well, I remember seeing that picture of her, and the last picture of her, the one of her on her own after she met Liz Truss. I think we're all saying, oh, she's got years left.
Yeah, she looked great.
And it was still, it was days, wasn't it? Thing. And then a couple of days later, they were like, wow.
I genuinely thought I'd be planning for centenary coverage on things,
Yeah, but I think it's also, it just shows you in a world that changes so much, where nothing today is the same as tomorrow, that there was that one thing that pretty much no matter how old you were, the Queen has been there for all of it.
Yeah, yeah.
And how many things in the world can you say that about, particularly people, let alone institutions, businesses, whatever. And so when you lose that, it is, even if you're not a citizen, even if you're not particularly a fan of it, it is still something you have to notice. And that's why I think the transition to Charles and how well it's gone and how smoothly it's gone is, again, just a reminder that we do want something in our lives, that even if we don't control it or have a say over it, is there over us somehow.
Mick, I want to come to you, because a lot of people complained, I remember, about it's seemingly endless coverage of the Queen's death. There's a mourning period. Yeah. I know, as a broadcaster, I was instructed to only do stories about the royals for a certain number of days. People don't quite understand why that is, that we all went so big for so long on the Queen's death and the Queen's funeral. But that's the instruction, isn't it?
Well, it's not so much an instruction, but it's, I think particularly these days, I think, if she died maybe 10, 20 years ago, it would have been, there would have been more, felt like an instruction. But I think, I don't know, it felt natural to me. It wasn't forced. The country, look at that queue that formed to look at it. It wasn't
trying to phone in on it every night. That's hard.
I don't
know. 2 weeks for you, but
I don't know if there was, because there wasn't so much different media in 1997, but I felt way more smothered by the coverage of Diana's death. Mm. I really did. But,
when the Duke of Edinburgh died, it felt, not forced, but again, just thinking in terms of him, he probably didn't want it as wall-to-wall as it was, because the way he was and his personality. And I think some broadcasters particularly saw it as is almost a little run out to see how the plans before mm-hmm. when the Queen died. And a lot of broadcasters for years and years and years have had these plans ready to go, all the various stages, all of how where things move. And it was a big set piece over another 10, 11 days or whatever it was. But just thinking back, it didn't feel forced. I was new to television then. It just felt natural. I think the world, this country, needed that time, that coverage. And if you didn't want to put it on, turn it off. Don't read the newspaper, whatever it is. But millions of people, newspapers, you know, the sales went up hugely. People did see it as this big historic moment, collectors' newspapers. But she meant a hell of a lot. It was a genuine, genuine story every single day.
I mean, it's a nice alignment, too, between the commercial imperatives of the news business these days and the subject matter. It just happened to be a happy thing that you pump out as much as you can. It would also be good for, and that's not
look,
why.
Well, we didn't why run adverts on GB News. Newspapers, I don't think there was advertising revenue or anything like that. So it wasn't as if people made a lot of money apart from the cover price or anything like that and things like that. It was just a very respectful, genuinely, you know, interesting news story that people, you know, were engaged
with. Well, I asked the question because on air I get messages saying, are you you're still talking about that, are you? You're still talking about I'm bored of it now, move on. Yeah. But we were told a certain number of days and then we could...
Well, until
like
after the
poppy.
Funeral, it felt like...
For a certain number of days and then you don't wear it anymore.
Because I had to do, and you know, this palace show I do is one day a week, I had to do 12 episodes and it was like by day 13 I was like, oh, I don't have to wear black today.
Yes.
This is so awesome.
Talking of Diana, I mean, it's still, I think, the biggest royal story. And Mick, perhaps you can help me with this. And it seems that you just need to put a picture of Diana on the front page of a newspaper and it will sell an extra few thousand
copies.
There
was a time in terms of, again, it was slightly before my time on the Express, but there was still this idea. Look, going back to it, the outpouring of grief for Diana seemed to be slightly more than for the Queen, because I think in terms of the Queen, we were prepared for it, whereas Diana was this huge shock. And I think Diana was still, there's still mystery surrounding how she died, or there appears to be. There was calls for the inquest and things like that. So there was genuine stories in that, and then there was the inquest in Paris. And so I think people genuinely did think they weren't being told the actual truth about that. And I think that's gone away now. And, you know, when I was at the Express, on the Daily Express, 2018, around about then, you know, it didn't guarantee you extra 10,000 sales like it might have done 5-10 years earlier. So that there is the diminishing returns on that. But again, people still are fascinated by these people and always will be. And it's going to be, you know, pictures of Meghan on the front page many years after she passes, when she's 100, hopefully. But it'll still sell newspapers. People are always going to be interested.
In the 90s, when Diana was alive, I was editing women's magazines, glossy fashion magazines. And it was so well known in those days that there was nobody in the world who sold magazine covers like Diana, and there's genuinely been nobody since Diana who has that absolute
same thing,
guaranteed effect, including Meghan and Kate.
Well, it was things, I mean, I remember being the same group as OK. It was when Katie Price was in her prime, but again, didn't come anywhere near something like Diana.
Andrew, if I can come to you and talk about Prince Andrew. Obviously, you're our Prince Andrew.
who I'm actually named after. So my mum, who's a Brit.
Stop it.
And I have a sister, her name is Anne.
He'd give all you guys a bad name.
Fact.
Fact.
Thanks, Mom. Especially after the Newsnight interview.
So
fuck me.
Our Prince Andrew.
Yes.
In PR terms, how do you think the Prince Andrew story, that the recent one, was handled by the royals?
I mean, like, how many times can you bring the barge pole out, right? Like, it's like, no, pal, you're still really verboten. No, and I wrote at the time after he completely, like, that mateless interview will go down. Like, I don't care how long people are doing interviews in the annals of PR history, that will always be like one of the top five worst interviews. And like, I was watching it and like through my fingers, like just out of shock. And I wrote at the time, like, he has got to take a lesson from the 60s in Britain and Perfumo and just disappear. And go do your work in an East End charity somewhere without drawing any attention to it for a good long period. You know what happened to Perfumo? The Queen gave him honors after he did that, and he came back. You don't moan about it. You don't whine about your lot in life.
You don't keep trying to come back.
Look, Epstein is like, there is no good answer for that. There is no good answer for having your arm around that young child. You know, there is like, and then all the I don't sweat. I remember being at the Pizza Express because, like, why would I be there? And it's memorable, like, all that stuff. And he's got, and this is to the point we're making at the start of the podcast. These people don't have anybody in their lives that will just grab them and go, "You're a fucking moron. Like, stop this." And then you compound that where he was apparently the Queen's favorite child. So he's probably gotten away with a lot more than other people would have gotten away with. And has imbued that attitude that I can be this ridiculous.
See.
And I can go to Bahrain and have my holiday and party with my royal friends there if they'll have me, kind of thing. And you just look.
Things
so
you can't always tell with the British public, though. And he's probably watched I'm a Celebrity with Matt Hancock, and he's think, actually, I might have a chance here. There are people out there.
And he could eat sheep's vagina too.
I really don't mind if he wants to go and have some snakes sort of like, you know, wrapped around his head. I'll be for that. Yeah.
Well, one of my best mates, Sam McAllister, that persuaded this interview to happen. And she said that while it was going on, she literally could not believe that nobody had advised him that this was going to go this wrong. And after the interview, he went, "I thought that went rather well."
Isn't it extraordinary?
I thought that went rather well.
And so did Sarah Ferguson, and so did the daughter. And I think that nobody would ever dare
say that was
well.
Awful.
No, he didn't die in the chair.
But he wouldn't.
But he thought it went well.
I think he was possibly the type of person for whom, if you tried to give that advice and that criticism, he wouldn't listen.
Well, no, and this is the thing. If you're in a job like mine where you're advising someone like that or a prime minister,
what would you have said?
Your only value to them is if you tell them, look, that was fucking awful. Yeah. Like, we're in trouble. And if you're broadcasters, you get this. You're listening to that interview unspool in real time. You're like, clip, oh, clip, clip, oh, can lead with a clip, oh, clip, oh, clip, clip. Usually you get one or two out of an interview, and there was about 1,500 of him looking like a complete idiot.
But it was a brilliant night for Sunday newspapers. Saturday night,
God,
TV, brilliant. Thank you very much.
I watched it from behind a cushion, the Daleks when I was a kid. Why did
to
he
use
agree
the word
to
extraordinary?
It?
I mean,
because he believes his own his own PR that exists in his own head, and he genuinely thought that he was going to play a blinder and get the public on his side. Yeah. He thought his story was
he's an honourable man doing
one.
The honourable thing.
Yeah.
Being a friend
to
the pedophile.
Involved somewhere as well.
There's definitely a courtier.
You'll be fine, boss.
I mean, this is one of the Jasons that we were talking about earlier, who then went on to work for Liz Truss.
He might be the Queen's favourite son, but he is famously probably the least popular royal within the palace walls. No one's got a good word to say about him.
The shame was, he was a Falklands War hero, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Was he?
Yeah, he flew helicopters.
Oh, he did.
It could have gone a lot. Yeah, it could have been a lot.
But I can just imagine if you're told you've got a royal opening your pub or something, and he turns up, it's like, ah. Oh.
Yeah.
Not that one.
Have you got anyone else?
Have you got anyone else?
Yeah.
Right. I just want to quickly touch on Paul Burrell before we move into PR cock-up of the week. I mean, this man has made a fortune out of digging out Diana, hasn't he? Every story, toenail clipping, you name it. How is he viewed as a golden goose or?
Oh, I don't know. I think I haven't really seen his name in anything I've worked on.
He runs
on
a flower
for
shop
quite
now.
A long time. Mm. I think he's sort of like just a bit of a tragic figure now, isn't he?
Mm. Yeah, he's fairly damaged goods in terms I think he used to be someone you go to.
He was a grade A traitor, wasn't he? He was known as that is treacherous to do.
Well,
to
many people it was treacherous, but it did seem, I read something somewhere that, he split up with his wife, didn't he? And then a few years later he set up with his new partner, and yet even after all that time the Queen still sent a present. So there was still that,
There was some...
There's some connection there. There's still that.
Personally, I always found it a bit crass.
I found it a bit creepy.
Yeah.
What did you think?
Yeah, I mean, this is just one of those things that once you break that norm, a bit of the magic goes, right? And it just becomes tawdry and sad. And it's the kind of thing a generation before it happened the first time. Nobody would have dared done that.
But he's still dragged out.
About it, though, is it's only people who have butlers. He's bringing butlers back.
Have you
back,
not got
no,
one? No,
but everyone wants a butler.
Everyone's got a butler, apart from Nick, apparently.
I would love to have a butler.
I'd love to have a butler. Yeah.
But that's the weird thing. That was what makes the whole thing weird. We've normalised the fact we're talking to a man who's a butler. and that's the royal family.
I'm a celeb. Right, let's have a look at the royal, perhaps, cock-up of the week, because I can think of one, at least. Joe, as you're the guest star.
Oh, God, do you know what? I went in to do Palace Confidential the other day, and we were going to have a lovely, jolly old chat about frocks in Boston and maybe Netflix, And then this happened. It's like, oh, I don't want to talk about race with it. It's so sad, the whole thing that happened from beginning to end. This black charity boss called Ngozi Fulani was at a Buckingham Palace do to, it was put on by Camilla, hosting lots of charity workers who work with abused women, domestic violence victims. And I know that Camilla is very, very passionate.
She's been doing that for years.
Very dedicated to this cause. She does amazing work in shining a spotlight on all of that. So it's a real shame that Lady Susan Hussey approached this woman, moved her hair off her name badge, so touched her really unnecessarily, saw her name and said, oh, where are you from? So, you know, Hackney, ma'am. And actually, no, where are you really from? No, where are your people from? Which went on in a hideous amount of time. I hate that. I hate that she did that. But I hate that now this old woman has been hung, drawn and quartered in public. I hate the people who have said, well, she's old, she's from a different time, like, which is really patronising and ageist about people's intelligence about these things. I hate that Camilla's work got overshadowed, and I just think the whole thing...
And the subsequent pylon, of course, everybody's coming out and saying...
And it's, you know, it's played right into the hands of Harry and Meghan getting their humanitarian award for exposing racism at the palace. Apparently, the whole thing is I think the palace behaved badly. I think the woman's behaved badly. I think everybody has not covered themselves in glory.
Well, the way William responded as well. And going back to that point I made earlier about the way that the royal family have treated people who have worked for them. She's just gone, isn't she? That's it.
It was sort of unedifyingly swift.
There was someone I went to school with was one of the women at that event. She works for charities for domestic abuse victims. She was a victim of domestic abuse when she was like 19, 20. Lost two of her kids, put into care, only now speaks to them again. And she's now had this totally overshadowed by what's happened. And it is such a shame.
It's a parable for the age, right? I think we've forgotten as a society how to be charitable towards others and forgiving. Mm. And now it's all about who can be the more aggrieved party in any dispute. And that, at the end of the day, is unedifying. It's unhelpful. It doesn't move a discussion forward. It doesn't help people get past stuff. It's just, I mean, it's unfortunate.
Yeah, and as you say, plays right into their award.
This story about speculation about Archie's skin colour, they can't even agree on
who said it
and when and in what context. So for some huge institution with a Kennedy at the helm of it to basically be saying, we are presenting as fact that they have exposed racism in the royal family and we're going to give them a war for it is just bizarre.
The spotless Kennedys.
Yeah.
With the vaccine denying.
Well, I think it was Cressida Bonus who was in the papers the other day with
she just had a baby.
Didn't she look happy?
Yes, she did.
The ones who aren't
dodged a bullet.
They're pretty at me these days, aren't they?
Yeah, well, she never wanted it, did she?
No. Nick, what's your PR?
Well, I think, you know, in terms of this show and the royal family, it's that event. It was such a shame because GB News, we were supposed to be doing a piece on, so this girl I went to school with, and she doesn't really want to do anything surrounding that event now simply because of what's happened. And it's a shame because these causes get overlooked. And yeah, we've had 3 or 4 days of a very good news story throughout. But unfortunately, you know, this cock-up has meant that, you know, the real stories, you know, of people in real Britain and their real hardships and the real things that they're going about and how the royal family, in that context the other day, that whole event was supposed to be them doing good and ended up doing bad.
Yeah, I'm going to give another award to Prince Andrew, just like a lifetime achievement award.
Lifetime achievement,
like, yeah. I mean, this Bahrain piece is only the latest one of like, why doesn't anybody love me anymore? Like, just come on, give up. Enjoy the lodge. There's quite a space. It's like, be happy that Sarah still talks to you.
But if you phoned him, if you phoned your namesake now and said, I'm going to give you an award, he'll be here.
He's
hole
right
through
behind
that
you.
Door. Like, yeah, it's just coming in, big now, grin.
Why didn't we think of that?
But I mean, again, it just shows you that psychological need that hasn't been met in their lives. And the fact that when you don't have a purpose in your life, really, that you do fall for everything.
Yeah, because he was the
You
spare.
Do hang out with the pedophiles that show a bit of interest in you, you know? And that, I mean, that at the heart of it, that, there's a profound sadness in this whole royal adventure that we've talked about a bit here, is that it is a very bizarre, peculiar, and unfriendly experience. Like, who would want that kind of fame in life, right?
No.
But you said Andrew's the spare. It wasn't Anne the spare. She's cool.
I don't think she was ever seen as the spare, though, was she? But Andrew was
number two.
Yeah.
Yeah, before they changed the rules.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Allowed the ladies a chance to...
I mean, yeah.
It's just outrageous.
Outrageous. These women should be at home. On that note, Joe, Elvin, thank you very much indeed. You've got another podcast coming out, haven't you?
I forgot. Thanks for reminding me. Called Fame, and where a lot of celebrities get asked one or two questions in a big rounded interview. Oh, what's it like to get recognised? Can you go to your favourite restaurant?
Yeah.
But this is... I've tried really hard to do a real deep dive into what really happens in your head when you know the minute you, when you have to arrange your face when you walk into every room because you know.
Do tell me you've got Megan.
I don't think Megan probably likes me very much, given some of my paymasters. But
not after this podcast.
No,
either.
Exactly. So that is out now. We've got Amy Schumer, we've got Jamila Jamil, we've got like all sorts of different fame. So soap fame with Tracy Ann Oberman. What it's like when your fame is eclipsed by your son. So we've got Dominic Holland talking about his son, Spider-Man. So there's a lot of really different voices on there. So hopefully people like it.
Sounds brilliant. Not as good as this one, obviously.
Oh, no, nothing is. No.
No. Nick Booker, thank you very much indeed. I wasn't going to ask you. You look worried there. I was going to ask you a question about another podcast. Hacks and Flacks.
<This one. laughs>
And Andrew, have you got anything else you want to add?
Well, just thank you for having this colonial here to dump all over our royal overlords.
I'm another one.
Well, no, I'm not a Republican, though. Like, I might not understand the monarchy, but I know the importance constitutionally and societally, and I will forever be grateful. Maybe.
And you didn't say sheep's vagina.
I did.
Oh, no, you said it once.
I worked it in.
I told you twice.
Nick opened the door and I came barreling through.
The way you were about to end that was going to be the national anthem next.
Yeah. No. Or sheep's vagina.
Well, there's a time of great change. Yeah. So, yeah, you just never know.
We'll see you next time for more Hacks and Flacks. Hacks and Flacks is presented by me, Petrie Hoskin, produced by Amanda Redman, and brought to you by Trafalgar Strategy. If you want to get in touch with your take on the current news climate, you can do that by emailing us at hackflackpod@gmail.com. And don't forget to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Thanks so much for listening. We'll see you next time on Hacks and Flacks.